Welcome to A Piece of My Mind, a project that uses storytelling and art to rediscover what connects us. I'm John Noltner, the founder and director of A Piece of My Mind, and I have the good luck to travel the country and the world photographing people to reveal the beauty and wisdom that's all around us, if we choose to see it. This new season is called Still Here, and for these stories, we traveled to coastal Louisiana. During our 9 days in the state, we heard a lot about disappearance. Not only are marshes and barrier islands vanishing, but so is black-owned farmland. So are the livelihoods of shrimpers and the tradition of eating Gulf seafood. So are local grocery stores, neighborhood music clubs, affordable houses. And yet, we met people who were planting their stakes in this marshy ground saying, "We're still here. We're not going away. This place is too precious to abandon." Their hard work and the work of others like them is key to the survival of the lower 48's most fragile coastline and a model for the rest of the country. Thanks for tuning in to listen to their stories. For this series, we're partnering with longtime friend and journalist Barry Yeoman. Based in North Carolina, Barry has lived and worked in Louisiana and has written extensively about the complexities of culture, environment, and economy along the state's coastline. It's his voice you'll hear leading the interviews.
Hi.
Hi.
So even before we start, I just want to tell you that I'm kind of giddy about being here.
Me too.
It's been a couple of years and I've missed you.
I've missed you, Barry. So great to see you. And I'm glad that my family was outside so you could tell them, hey.
Me too.
Yeah,
me
too. It was wonderful.
So let's start by my asking you to introduce yourself and tell us where we are.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Chief Devin Parfait. I wear a number of different hats. Of course, I'm the chief of my tribal community, the Grand Cayo Dulac Band of Biloxi, Chittimacha, Choctaw. It's a total mouthful, but it really underscores the amount of history and diversity of tribal communities that existed here in the area. I'm also a board member of First Peoples Conservation Council, the vice chair of the Native American Commission and the Governor's Office of Indian Affairs. And for my day job, I'm a coastal resilience analyst for the Environmental Defense Fund, where I work as a science coordinator for the Restore the Mississippi River Delta Coalition, which is a coalition of nonprofits all working towards coastal protection and restoration.
That's a lot of stuff.
So much, Barry.
And where are we sitting right now?
And right now, we're sitting here in our family's garage with a lot of my grandpa's knickknacks and things that he's collected over the years on the West Bank in Marrero.
You have a remarkable history in your 27?
Seven. I was talking with somebody yesterday and we had to figure out how old I was because I forgot. So yeah. 27, yes.
Yeah. So tell me about Little Devin before he was Chief Devin.
Yeah. So, you know, the reason that we're sitting in Marrero is because my story is inherently a story of displacement. I used to live down the bayou with my family right on the water in Dulac on Shrimper's Row. My grandpa owned a shrimp boat. We had a dock where my grandpa would raise worms. So we were able to take worms, put them on a hook, fish right off the dock. My grandpa would clean the fish. He'd take the fish heads, put them in a crab trap, would catch crabs, eat crabs. We had a fig tree. And then, of course, we'd also take the shrimp boat and go out. And every so often, we'd go for a couple days, catch shrimp. Young Devin would play with the bycatch, whatever we caught. Had no idea you could catch pufferfish in Louisiana. And so that was really cool. And then, you know, whenever I was in second grade, Hurricane Katrina and Rita both hit Louisiana. And for my family down the bayou, Katrina wasn't that bad for us. It really messed up New Orleans and a lot of the surrounding area, but we didn't experience all of the storm surge or anything else that would have been devastating for us. But the problem was shortly after Katrina, Rita hit us. And when Rita hit, that left storm surge in the area for weeks, and in some places up to 14 feet. When I came back, my family made it a point to let us go in and see what had happened to the house. And when we went in, everything was just covered and caked in mold. And young me, you know, we could only take what we could carry on our backs and in our cars. And my most prized collection at the time was a collection of zoo books. You know, those zoo books that you'd see, and you'd see the ads for TV, and you'd see all the anatomical structure and everything. My grandma ended up purchasing a subscription for me, and I would look forward to my zoo books coming in every month. And I'll never forget going into my room and looking at the bottom shelf of the bookshelf and seeing my collection of zoo books just totally puffed up and full of mold. It was devastating for me. I mean, devastating for so many reasons, but young me, my whole zoo book collection gone. And my family made a decision at that point. And they said, we are going to have to move. This is too much. And all of the insurance wasn't really panning out the way that it needed to. We really didn't get the money that we were supposed to. It was so hard for us to find a place to live after Katrina and Rita, because so many people had moved all across the state, especially after Katrina. And so we ended up going to my family's house in Lacombe, which is just northeast of Lake Pontchartrain. And I stayed there for about a year. So my third grade year, I spent at a completely different school, just trying to find another place to live. And my grandpa at one point was traveling on the North Shore and was looking for a place. And he ended up traveling to Bush, Louisiana. And he just so happened, as he was driving by, saw somebody nailing in a for sale sign. And he went and asked them about it. And we ended up getting a place then.
Wow.
And so we moved up north, and still in Louisiana, the toe part of the boot, I like to say. And we stayed there for me from about fourth to seventh grade. And then my mom got tired of the country life, and she had a job in New Orleans that she was traveling to every day. And so she wanted to move us back closer to home and on the West Bank. So we moved on the West Bank, and my grandparents stayed in Bush. My grandpa was still a tugboat captain at the time. He's retired now. But he was also making that travel back and forth all the way from Bush, Louisiana, traveling all the way down the bayou to catch his ride on the tugboat so that he could drive it. For a while, my family was kind of separated out. My mom and my sister was living with her friend, and I was living with my uncle. And eventually, this is something I don't really talk about all that often, but my uncle was really into drugs, and he was suffering with a lot on his own, and he ended up taking his own life. And that kind of was a huge upheaval for my family. I was in eighth grade at the time, going to a middle school, Ellender. And eventually, after all of that craziness had kind of died down, me and my family moved back into a house together. It was my mom, my sister, and me. And we stayed on the West Bank. And because I had made that move, I went to a totally different school district and went to high school separate from where the friends I had made in middle school. So a lot of my story was just constantly moving schools, making new friends, and getting used to different environments.
That's a lot of trauma.
Yes, yes.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. You know, I think that I found a productive way to take those things and put it towards something that matters. And every day is another step, you know, especially with the craziness in this world today. Everybody's got something that they're dealing with on their own, and it just takes one step at a time.
So as you're moving around, how much are you holding your Indianness?
Well, that was a real struggle for me growing up, especially being more white passing. And knowing that at 12 years old, I would be the future chief of the tribe. You know, I talked about my displacement and moving around a lot, but we'd often go back and visit down the bayou and visit family and visit Sherelle. And there was at one point where we had a conversation at 12 years old for hours and hours and hours. I mean, I was just yapping at Sherelle, just talking to her, asking her all these questions, like, why are you chief and what do you do? And she started talking to me about why she was chief and why she did it, where it came from. For her, it was her heart. She cared deeply about the family and about doing good in the world and trying to make some kind of change. And I asked why that was necessary. You know, what kind of things are happening and what kind of work do you do? And she started talking to me about the environmental challenges, the societal challenges that the tribes face, even at a young age. And she talked to me about federal acknowledgement and why previous chiefs and her were working on federal acknowledgement and why she thought that was important to help get recognition for our tribe and be able to access resources from the federal government that might be able to be used to help protect our community. And I asked her in that moment, well, is there anything I can do? How can I help? And her recollection of the story is that at that moment, she felt like the ancestors were with her. And she thought, man, maybe this guy could be the next chief, because she had a recognition that being a chief is not about power or money. It's about love and care and being in service to your people. And so not too long after that, I was in the car with my mom and she asked me, hey, you know, Sherelle wants to know if you want to be the future chief someday. And I said, man, that sounds pretty cool. Like, love the sound of that. And then I also knew where it came from, good heart and doing stuff for your family. And so I said, yes. And from then on, I was the future chief.
Wow. So I'm just trying to imagine what it would be like to live inside your body as a teenager, a history of displacement, the knowledge that you'll be the future chief. What was high school like for you?
You know, high school, actually, it came right off the heels of my uncle's death. I really never saw school as the way to be chief. I always thought being chief was more about community service, you know, picking up boxes, helping rebuild homes, like just going out and helping people as much as possible. I never saw school playing any part of that. Why go to school to help carry boxes and build homes? And at the time, I didn't realize how much that my uncle's death had affected me, but it really did. And I didn't really engage with school. It was one of the loneliest times of my life. I can point to a couple of them, but going to a new high school, you know, you're young. High school is nerve-wracking, awkward, and being a freshman going to this new school where I knew nobody. And I remember my first classes, my first class was a math class, and I would go into that class, I would put my head down, and I would sleep. The teacher tried to wake me up, you know, for the first couple weeks to engage me and make sure I was doing my work, but eventually she would slide the paper underneath my arm and just let me sleep through class. I ended up finishing that freshman year with all Fs, an F in every single class, gym class.
Wow.
All you have to do for gym is dress up. And I just did not engage whatsoever. And so after that, it was kind of embarrassing to go back to the school because I was still technically a freshman. So I had to wear khaki shirts. And I remember being at the clothing store and just and begging my mom, please just buy me like the white or blue shirt so I don't have to go in as a freshman again. Because I spent 5 years in high school because of that failed first year. And I think that my life story is a little unique because everybody's trying to carve the path and figure out where their destination is going to be. But for me, I already knew where my destination was. I just had to carve the path on my own. And so I never saw school being a part of that path. And so I just didn't engage with it as fully as I should have. And whenever I graduated high school, I ended up trying to apply to college. I actually made the excuse to my mom saying that I was taking a semester off, but I actually had no idea how to engage in the college process, how to start applying to college. I didn't really want to ask my mom about it or ask a whole lot of her from it. So I just said, I'm taking the semester off. And I rolled ice cream and made snowballs. And that was really great. Eventually, the semester was passing. It was time for me to apply to college. And I made the best decision I possibly could in the moment, which was I applied to community college. And I was able to get a Pell Grant. And the Pell Grant was just perfectly able to pay for my tuition. And so I started doing community college, just taking general studies classes, still having no idea what direction I was going to go with college. I started asking myself, you know, what about engineering? What about, electrical, mechanical, chemical? Should I do something? I need to do something that pays me a lot of money, because that's why everybody goes to school these days. It's how can I make enough money to provide for my family and to provide a good life for myself? I thought through a lot of things, but never really landed on anything and spent 3 semesters just doing general studies at community college.
And then your life shifts.
Yes. So then I end up getting an email from Rona Cox, who is a professor at Williams College. And she asked me in that email if I wanted to go be a part of this science conference in Seattle. And I thought, wow, that'd be pretty cool. I get to travel. She wanted somebody to be there on a, to be there on behalf of the tribe. And she was giving a presentation about the plights of Southern Native Americans, because she engaged a lot with Sherelle and would bring students down and talk to Sherelle about land loss and the environmental issues that we face down here. And not many people knew about it. Nobody even knew that Natives existed in Louisiana, in broadly in the United States, but even in our own state, people didn't realize how many Native Americans were here. And so she wanted to platform that and give us a voice. And so I traveled up there with my brother. I remember he had a silver suitcase that he was traveling with. He looked pretty cool with it. We went up, and honestly, Barry, I thought that there were going to be tables of beakers and people in lab coats because that's what I thought science was. I never thought it was what I'll talk about later, which is something that's more applied, that's based around passion. And that's what I saw at that conference, just people so passionate about the things that they were working on, whether that was a specific kind of rock that they were interested in or if they were working with a community. Some things just totally went over my head. Other things I started really engaging with. And Rona saw how engaged I was, and she asked me, well, would you want to try and speak after the presentation? I was a little nervous, and I said, yeah, I would love to do that. I remember we sat at the table and we came up with some ideas and drafted some language. And when I went up to speak after Rona had spoke, I gave my address, and it was so well received from people. And people came up to me after and wanted to let me know, this is who I am, this is what I do, I'd love to help. And that was the moment where I truly felt power in my voice, that I could use my voice to help advocate for my tribe and bring resources back down south and do some good work. And that was the aha moment for me. It's like, oh, okay, so this is what this educational stuff can do. Okay. So at the end of it, you know, the whole time I was engaging with Williams students, and I thought, wow, all of these Williams students are so smart and charismatic, and they just have it going on, like so well educated. And I was like, I want to be one of these Williams students. And Rona must have felt that and asked me towards the end when she was handing me money for reimbursement. She had asked, well, would you want to try and go to Williams? It kind of felt like a huge Hail Mary. You know, I am somebody who graduated high school with a 1.8 GPA. I failed gym class. I couldn't get above a 22 on the ACT. Williams College's transfer acceptance rate was 2% at the time. And so it was a huge Hail Mary. But she said, hey, there might be some options here. We can try and see. And if you get in, this would be a really good education for you at little cost. So I did what I could. She said, first thing you need to do is you need to raise your grades up. So I'm like, okay, great. I can do that and retake the ACT test. So I finished off my last semester of community college with all A's, straight A's in the classes. And then as I was studying for my ACT test, it was actually the first time that I'd ever gone to a library to study. I actually sat down in a library, bought a book from a guy who made a perfect ACT score, and studied that book front to back, made the commitment to sit down, practice those problems, and finish that book. And then I went and took my ACT test. And in some categories, I ended up scoring a 33 and a 32, which was more than 10 points from where I had been before. It's amazing what can happen when you actually sit down and study and spend some time learning.
Yeah.
Eventually, I was rolling ice cream, and I had a customer that I was rolling ice cream for, and I had my phone next to me, and I saw that Rona was calling. And I told the customer, I'm like, I am so sorry. I'm getting a really important phone call. I passed my paddles off to the to my coworker, and I said, they're going to put the syrup in it just like you like. I promise they'll fix it up all nice for you. And I went to the back with all the boxes, and I was on the phone with Rona. And she said, hey, Devin, I just wanted to call you and let you know the decision from admissions. You're going to get an email, but I just wanted to let you know that they decided not to move forward with your application at this time. And she said, but don't worry, you know, there might be some other options that we could see if we could go for. And I knew it was a Hail Mary. I didn't really feel a certain way about it because I knew it was a long shot anyway. So I was like, okay, let's see what Rona might be able to come with, to come up with. I'll just put it on pause. Eventually, she called me back and she said, well, you could do the Williams Mystic program, because when I had gotten the email, the only reason that they had rejected my application was that they thought that I wasn't ready for their level of coursework yet. And so the Williams Mystic program is a Williams-sponsored program that was the program that went down and talked to Elder Chief Sherrell. And it was how Rona had engaged with Elder Chief Sherrell, and who was Chief Sherrell at the time, and applied for Williams Mystic. It's a semester-long program that is its own independent thing at the Mystic Seaport, where you study across disciplines on one topic, the oceans and the coast, from a policy, science, historical, and literature lens. And I got in on a full scholarship. And this program offered me so much support when I got in. I mean, I was somebody who didn't know how to put citations in a paper. I never really engaged with academics like these other folks who were coming into the program, who are juniors and seniors from Harvard and Smith and Brown and Williams, these colleges that people work all of their lives to get into. And I got the opportunity to go into this program. And it really did build me to be academic from the ground up. I got to do original research to ask questions about coastal erosion. You know, that was the first time where I got to go out and study a marsh and look at what the actual coastal erosion process looks like for plants and animals to help protect the soil and what it meant when they didn't. I got to travel around the country and meet people from different government agencies, from other nonprofit organizations, from community leaders who were taking action in their own ways in their own communities. And I got to also do this along with people who I had grown so fond of and professors who had really helped to engage me in ways that I had never been engaged before. I was very lucky because it was hard for me to organize my time, that we were all doing things at the same time. So if a group of students was going to a certain building to do work for a class, I knew I had to go to that building and do work for that class. And I remember asking one of the students, how do you organize your time? Like, what do you even do? And they started talking to me about Google Calendar and how they time block and put things on the calendar. And that's when I got my first introduction to how a calendar just rules my life now. It was an incredible experience. I mean, for me, it was the best of times and worst of times because I really struggled with the academics of it all. You know, I showed up at Williams Mystic with a stack of books. And I'd only read a couple books in my life, and seeing that whole stack of books larger than all of the books I'd probably read in my entire life was really intimidating for one semester.
So many people believed in you.
Yes. Yeah.
We all ride on other people's shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And eventually this gets you into Williams College.
Yes. So I ended up graduating Williams Mystic. I got good grades out of it, proved that I can handle the Williams rigor. And I remember talking with Rona. I said, like, this has been so fulfilling and so amazing. I want to keep this momentum going. I don't want to stop. And so she thought through some ideas. We thought maybe I could be a research assistant at the college or something. And eventually she said, well, I'm going on sabbatical and I need somebody to take care of my guinea pigs for me. And I also have an extra room at my house. Rona also set me up with four classes to audit. It was three geoscience classes along with one American studies class. She got me set up with a meal plan at the college, just like a regular student. And the goal was to take those classes just like a regular student and get recommendation letters from those professors to say that I'm doing well in the classes and I'm handling the coursework. And it was actually one moment. I was taking an American studies class from a native professor. He was a native, trans, white-presenting professor, dealt with a whole lot of different identities. And I remember when I first got to that class, he said, we are not starting with Christopher Columbus in American studies class. There is so much history way further back that we need to go through before we even get there. The time that most people talk about in American studies classes is only a small sliver of time compared to the entirety of indigenous history in the United States. And that was amazing. And I got to learn from this professor. We had office hours. And by the end of that class, I had felt so comfortable and fully claiming my identity and who I am and recognizing that it doesn't matter what my skin color looks like or how I look. It's who I am, where I come from, my genealogy, and what I commit as a person to my identity. It was incredible. I just got to feel fully comfortable in who I was and my identity, and that really meant the world to me. It was also during that time where I took a mastering GIS class, and I had always really struggled with what I would do for college and what my major was going to be. It was still hard for me to connect earth science and environmental things to what I needed to do. But it wasn't until the final project for that class where I really struggled with how am I going to contribute back to my community in these 4 years where I'm more than 1,000 miles away. And in that class, we had discovered that there was many people who were looking at coastal land loss in Louisiana, but nobody was looking at the relationship of coastal land loss to Native American communities, especially those communities during the colonization of America that were pushed down to the furthest ends of the Gulf Coast. And so that's what my research did in the beginning of that class was I took, ended up taking two satellite images and one in the past and one in the future and comparing the rates of land loss between them and getting some numbers for it. And that was the moment, that was another aha moment for me where I'm like, okay, I can go to school, get an education for myself and contribute back to my community with this. And so I just continued doing geoscience things while I was there. So I ended up during that semester finishing up an application and we waited at that point. Eventually, I heard back from them and Williams College just totally accepted me with open arms. Like I will never forget after my application was accepted and went through, I was walking on campus and one of the admissions people was driving a car down the road and she stuck her hand out the window and was like, "Devin, hey, welcome." Like made it a whole big deal and everything. And I was slated to go into Williams the next fall semester.
Wow.
Yeah.
I just want to take a minute and breathe in that part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So you're at Williams, a full-fledged member of the community.
Officially, yes.
Officially. How does your time matriculating at Williams set the stage for becoming chief?
Yeah, so I continuously did my coastal land loss research. So I got in and said, I want to keep getting answers to this because I don't think that we have fully gotten there yet. Continued my research at Williams. Eventually, COVID hit during my time. And there was this Allison Davis Research Fellowship that you could apply for at the college. And I applied previously, but just wasn't able to get in. And somebody had left during COVID and they had offered me a spot. And so I was able to get a research fellowship that supported me monetarily and also helped to give me some professional development and research development, helping to get me the resource that I would need if I needed to go to graduate school or wanted to pursue education more. And I continued doing my research underneath that Allison Davis Research Fellowship. I included more communities in the coastal land loss research. I developed better methodology because trying to figure out what is watery mud versus muddy water in Louisiana is really difficult just through your eye, but especially through satellite imagery. That was one of the first times where I'd created a poster for land loss and how it relates to Native Americans. And when I took it to a conference, the first question I asked people was, did you know that Native Americans existed in Louisiana? And almost every single person said no. And then even further, I asked, did you know that Native Americans were experiencing these environmental issues in Louisiana? And of course, no, again. And so I continued doing that research and got opportunities to present that research on panels and at conferences and just continue to do that advocacy. The thing that I would always tell people and what we're doing right now is you give me a mic and I'll speak.
And to be clear, your work was showing that while the entire Louisiana coast was hemorrhaging, that parts of the coast where tribal members lived were taking an even bigger hit.
Yes. Because Native Americans were situated in the most undesirable lands in Louisiana, they are now disproportionately impacted by coastal land loss. And so Native American communities in their particular areas are experiencing greater amounts of land loss than the regional average.
You graduated Williams what year?
In 2022.
you're not expecting in 2020 that you're going to graduate and suddenly take over Chief Sherrill's job.
No, I was kind of expecting me to be chief way later in my life. I thought maybe 30s, maybe 40s or something, you know, whenever I get a little bit of years and experience to me, maybe we'll do a transition then. I remember while I was in quarantine, when I had COVID, as I was coming back to the college, I remember Sherrill called me at one point and she told me, "Chief, I think it's time." You know, she had a very frank conversation with me and she was like, "You got a much better education than any of us could have ever hoped for. And you are so well equipped to help deal with the issues that we're facing right now that I think it's time that you step into your role." And after I graduated in 2022, I officially got my job as a coastal resilience analyst with the Environmental Defense Fund, working with as a science coordinator with the Restore the Mississippi River Delta Coalition. But then I had also had a small COVID-safe ceremony with some tribal members where I officially signed those papers and became chief of the tribe.
So you become chief and you inherit all these existential challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Will you help me understand what those challenges were?
Yeah, so there are many challenges that the tribe faces. I mean, if we go back further back in history, a lot of the tribal community lived off of the land. You know, if you needed protein, all you had to do was set up some traps in the bayou and you were able to catch your protein and make your living. A lot of our shrimpers, as the economy began to grow when Louisiana was more heavily colonized, it was mostly based around trade and then eventually shifted to industrial agriculture and then inevitably the shift to oil and gas extraction. Along that way, a lot of shrimpers would make their money during the shrimping season, and they would usually have some income to help provide for themselves during the off season, really living from the land, being able to make your living from the land. I remember my grandpa told me a story that our family back in the day used to take moss off of the cypress trees and sell them to Ford to put in their seat cushions before they used all of the plastics and stuff. Eventually, as those shifts happened, more and more environmental degradation occurred. The oil and gas industry in particular did a lot to dig up canals across the entire Gulf Coast. You know, I would challenge anybody listening to go on a map like Google Maps and look at Louisiana and zoom into any part of that southern delta, and you will see these straight line canals crisscrossing across the entire landscape. And it is because of those canals that our gradient estuary of freshwater to brackish to saltwater ended up becoming a more saline environment. Those straight line canals allowed the saltwater to penetrate right through the delta and contributed a lot to the skeleton trees that you see out there now. Trees that are just the trunks of their former selves, no longer alive because they couldn't survive the salinity. And as the trees and the plants started to degrade away and canals were being cut, a lot of that erosion continued to occur all around the area. I mean, you hear stories in Louisiana about Isle Daenerys, the last island. There was a resort that was on there. You used to be able to get to that barrier island on a horse and buggy. Like, wow. There was a road that connected to it. And over time, a big hurricane hit. It was devastating for the resort. Many people died during that hurricane. And the road ended up sinking and eroding away. And obviously, now it's open water. And because the tribe was so in tune with the land and got all of their resources from nature, as that environmental degradation happened, so too did the availability to access those resources degrade. And society was also forming around these communities. Educational access was a huge issue, where there were these native schools that popped up, and then there were the white schools. And at the native schools, you weren't allowed to go back up, depending on what bayou you were on, 6th, 7th, or 8th grade. So you could only get an education to a certain point. So a lot of our community was barred from being able to get an education unless they were white passing or called themselves white or were able to go to the white schools in some way. So a lot of our tribal community was barred from getting an education that would allow them to participate in the society that was growing around them and really needed an education to be able to participate and to get a job, or you could sell your life and work in the oil and gas industry. That was something that my grandpa had done. You know, my grandpa reminisces about his life and really wishes that he could have been there for more of our family moments, because he worked on a 2 week on, 1 week off schedule, where he was gone for 2 weeks and came back home for 1 week. And most of the time you'd see him cutting grass and taking care of the yard and other things when he'd come back. So only about a third of his life was spent with us while he was working on the tugboat. Sold his life to be able to provide for our family. And so a lot of the community wasn't able to get jobs outside of the hospitality industry, oil and gas, healthcare, as a lot of it needed the education to go forward. And so as our tribe was being barred from getting a proper education and the environment was degrading, it left people with little to no options. A lot of our shrimpers who would traditionally shrimp and have a lot of income in the off season were noticing that they would have to shrimp more and more often and find a second job to be able to provide for themselves. At the same time, a lot of our culture, our heritage, and our language was taken from us. You know, at the schools, you weren't allowed to speak your language and got physically reprimanded for it. And I mean, the language down here is truly beautiful. It's a jargon of so many different things, native languages, along with Cajun French. There's other mixes in there. And so these lack of educational opportunities and environmental degradation led to an inability for our tribal community to be able to fully engage with the world and the wealth of the world that was being extracted in the ways that we should have. And so a lot of people down south still struggle. I mean, if you go down there, it almost looks like a third world country, not just because of all of those things that I mentioned before, but because of just a mismanagement of funds. A lot of times you see the worker bees who make the money don't actually inherit that wealth that they're making. Instead, it goes to very few people at the top. A lot of our tax dollars in Louisiana get extracted from the people who actually live here and work here and make the money, and instead go to the pockets of corporations and the very few people who make a lot of the profit. And that has really affected a lot of the community's ability to recover from environmental disasters like hurricanes, which are only multiplied by the lack of good infrastructure and investments in infrastructure in our hometown. And so these challenges, along with many others, are the reasons why it's so important that we engage folks and lead the way to try and get toward a future where we focus on the environment and the people first. Because if you don't have the environment, you don't have the people. And if you don't have the people, you don't even have an economy.
That is quite a mantle to put on the shoulders of a 25-year-old.
Yeah.
So you are sworn in as chief,
mm-hmm.
and you roll up your sleeves.
Yes. One of the first things that I did actually when I joined EDF was I started looking through as many files as I could. You know, what work are they doing? How are they doing it? In what ways? Like, what is making EDF successful as an organization? Because our tribe is organized as a 501c3 nonprofit. And so these other environmental organizations are also 501c3 nonprofits. So how are they operating and how are they able to get funds and get work done? And I started looking through my coalition's and EDF's strategic plans. And they came up with these plans, these strategies to be able to do work in the future and currently. And there was a long-term vision there. And I said, we need something like that for the tribe. We need to have a long-term vision, and we need to organize around categories of work so that we know what kind of work we need to do. Let's say Sherelle or I die, or something happens to us. Somebody else needs to have something where they can come in and pick up the pieces and continue the work and build off of what we had been building on. And so what I did over the next 3 years was to partner with other organizations, to partner internally with folks that were a part of the coalition. CRCL, the Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana, at the time was part of the coalition, and we started working more closely together. And it was just about building partnerships and relationships. I mean, tying this back to hurricanes, the better able you are to recover from a hurricane is totally dependent on the amount of prior existing relationships. And that's what I wanted to develop, as I wanted to connect more with people, with other organizations, and ask, what can we do together? How can we partner? And one of the very first conversations that I had was actually with CPEX, the Center for Planning and Excellence. And I had mentioned the strategic plan idea to them. And I said, what we really need is to do community interviews to capture people's stories and come up with a plan to help guide our work. And they helped us do that. They helped provide capacity to do the community interviews, to come up with a plan. And 3 years later, we have something that looks like a full foundation plan that we can continue to build off of and build on. Even more, CRCL helped us organize intergenerational community meetings. You know, one thing that I always tell people that I think a lot of these governmental and higher up institutions get wrong is that it's not only the experts that need to be engaged. Everybody has a valuable perspective to bring. Doesn't matter how old you are, doesn't matter what your title is. Everybody has a good perspective to bring, whether that's the lived generational experience of just being in place, or it's the specific expertise that was built upon through education or other means. And so we hosted this intergenerational workshop, and Sherelle's kids ended up coming. And the goal of the workshop was to try and think of where we could put a living shoreline. And I remember when Sherelle's kids came to the table that I was at, they threw their hands up and they were like, we have nothing to contribute here. We're just here because our mom told us to be. And I remember at one point we were getting super in the weeds of it. We were talking about salinity levels. And I paused. And I looked over to the young ones and I asked, what do you care about? What do you want to see protected? And Dale Jr. thought for a second. And he said, well, you know, I really love going fishing with my family in Bayou Salé. You know, we'll either go or we'll take a boat and go fishing down in Bayou Salé. And a lot of people care about that little fishing area. A lot of people go to it to catch fish and throw a cast net out. And people in that room knew about Bayou Salé, but nobody had ever brought that perspective in and marked that as a possibility for a project. He did. He brought that perspective and that lived experience. And so after that workshop, we had continued doing some work, made a map based on what people thought about the area, some possible projects that we might be able to work on. Eventually, we came together with Ducks Unlimited, Terrebonne Parish, CPRA, other tribal leaders, and we sat down in a circle and asked, what can we do together? That's the basis of any good collaboration that we've had so far is, what can we do or how can I help? And we kind of talked for a little bit and eventually Ducks Unlimited said, well, we do have these terraces that we have out in Northern Lake Boudreaux, but we didn't have enough money to fully plant on them. We just had enough money to build the terraces, which are basically just like rows of dash lines where they build up sediment or they drag up sediment from the ground to build it up into these dash line platforms. And they were able to plant on the outside of them, but not on the top. And so we said, well, maybe in partnership, we might be able to get some funds to help finish the planting. So we together applied for a CPRA partnership fund grant. And with the help of CRCL, we were able to get those funds. And actually a couple weeks ago, we went out and did those plantings in partnership with other tribal members and other volunteers, and went out and planted each one of those terraces. And to me, that's just an example of efficient and impactful work. How can we not work in silos? How can we share capacity with each other to be as efficient and impactful with our resources as possible?
And what will those terraces do?
They will help to provide habitat for the area, vital habitat for species to be able to have homes, but to also protect against the wave energy and storm surge that comes in for hurricanes. So it provides critical hurricane protection to a lot of the marshes in the area.
How have you grown as chief?
I think a lot of people look at me with my titles and things that I have now, and they kind of expect me to know everything. And I kind of struggled with that in the beginning because I'm somebody who has been displaced for my community. And I'm still reconnecting and learning and trying to participate and give myself as wholly as possible. But I don't know everything. And I'm still learning. And I think that as I've gone through my journey over the past couple years, one of the biggest things is knowing that I have a lot of expertise and I have a voice to bring, but I'm not always 100% right. And nobody ever really is. You know, everybody has a good, valuable perspective to bring. Everybody brings something new. And just being able to have conversations with people, to learn, to grow, to do good work, and to continuously improve my own advocacy and the way I think about things and the swath of things that I know now versus what I'll know whenever I end up as that, you know, 50, 60-year-old chief one day. I got started at a really early age and am learning a lot and know a lot now, but am comfortable that I don't know everything and that I love to learn. And, you know, being able to travel, to talk to so many different people, to work on these coastal restoration issues, I get to learn so much from people.
I have one more question for you before I then ask if there's anything I haven't asked. You are leading the tribe at the very moment where there's increasing hostility to environmental protection, conservation, environmental justice, acknowledging the special challenges that people who have been marginalized through history face. That can be corrosive. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what keeps you moving forward? Where do you find hope? Where do you find energy at this moment to keep on doing this work as an advocate for coastal restoration, as an advocate for the needs of your tribe?
In this moment where all of these political shifts are crazy and there's a lot of direct and indirect violence that's happening, I still remain really optimistic about the future because I know that the general arc of history is positive. This is only one moment in time. And as humans, oftentimes we can get too caught up in our short lifespans that we live. The way that I'm thinking about right now is generationally. What comes in the future, I believe, as the pendulum swings, will be so much better and greater than we can ever imagine. I mean, we've seen how much people have evolved over these years, the growth, the positivity, the historic investments in climate and the environment, the recognition that we need to put people in the environment first. I've seen that in so many different ways. And even in some of these institutions that people have said will never change, people have been in positions where they've actually done some good work. I see us in the future recognizing that we need to have a relationship with our planet, not just an extractive one, but one where we recognize the value. I think back to what this place in the United States looked like before colonization even happened. You know, I read stories of European settlers who would walk into forests that looked like parks with paths of berry bushes and fruit trees there. It was because the indigenous people knew that taking care of the planet came first, because if you didn't, then it wouldn't take care of the people. And I am very optimistic that all of the momentum that we've experienced as a society moving forward isn't going to go away just because one guy wants it to.
I'm wondering, before I let you go, is there any question you wish I would have asked you that I didn't?
Yeah, I'm actually going to go back and wrap up some of the things I said before about restoration.
Yeah.
So over the past 3 years, as I've been connecting with these other organizations, with government institutions, and developing this strategic plan, I realized that we need more. We need more resources and we need more capacity to share with other folks to really come up with a bigger plan and to develop a set of proposals so that when the right opportunity comes, we have a proposal ready. You know, we have a lot of needs in the community, but identifying those needs, putting them down on paper and creating a proposal to get funding is its own thing and takes years and years and years. One of the main reasons why I focus on coastal restoration is because I can't do everything. You know, I know a lot of community leaders have suffered throughout the years because of their big hearts and because they're educated and able to do things. They feel like they have to do everything and they suffer because of it. And so in my life, I'm trying to find a good balance between letting my heart do the work that it wants to do, but also making sure that I set it up so that the next leader doesn't have to do the back end work that Sherelle or myself or many other the tribal leaders have had to do in the past. And I'm so thankful to have all of the other leaders who've done the work that they've done, because I can't imagine trying to do the work that I'm doing now without being able to leverage the relationships that Sherelle has built, that First Peoples Conservation Council has built. I mean, I think of myself as like the next tribal generation, you know, like, what do they call it? Like a Nepo baby, but a tribal Nepo baby. So I inherited a lot of good work from people who have been so activated and engaged, and I'm just taking that next step. And so I ended up applying for this grant with some good partners from the Climate Migration Network. We applied for a one-year grant to create a tribal resilience plan, and then we also applied for a government grant to do a three-year tribal resilience plan. And we got both. And so now what we're doing is we have some members of the core team. We have people in the local parish involved, other tribal leaders, other nonprofit organizations, Lowlander Center, First Peoples Conservation Council, along with others who are out of state, who are helping us to take the relationships and the work that I've been doing over the past 3 years to culminate it together and have a more robust, filled out strategic plan that the tribe can have to do those things I mentioned before, to have those proposals, to come up with a set of policies that we may might be able to support, and to think generationally of what does our future look like on the Gulf Coast 10, 20, 30, 50 plus years down the line. There's this narrative, I think it's very doomerist, where people believe that the entire Gulf Coast is just going to vanish in the next several decades. Not even in CPRA's modeling under the worst conditions and a future with no action, do we have no land down here. And there's already plenty of great projects and things happening. So I think a life on the Gulf Coast is totally possible. There may be a moment where we'll have to consider that we might have to move, and we want to make sure that we have options for people to be able to leave and come back and have some continuity between the community. But I think it is totally possible to save what we have now. And this plan is going to help identify those needs and set everything in place so that we can do the good work and have our community survive and thrive for generations to come.
That feels like a good stopping place.
I think it is.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barry.
Thanks for tuning in to Still Here, a series produced by A Piece of My Mind. I'm John Noltner, the founder and director of A Piece of My Mind. Be sure to visit our website, listed in the episode notes, to see photos and video from this story. This series is produced with interview help from journalist Barry Yeoman, editing help from summer interns Kate West, Sawyer Garrison, and Caitlin Emai, and audio production by Rosick Seifela.